Hello, and welcome to the Live Retail Online Integration Webinar, Tips for Managing the Digital Content Journey Every Step of the Way. This webinar is sponsored by Bluetoad, a digital publishing company that converts PDFs into digital editions that are viewable on desktop and mobile devices. I'm Joe Keenan, Managing Editor of Retail Online Integration and the host of today's event. Joining me today to talk about how retail brands can leverage content to gain audience and grow sales are Joe Lazauskas, Editor-in-Chief of Contently, a company that helps brands create great stories, engage audiences, and deliver business results at scale with powerful software, world-class creative talent, and patent-pending technology that ties content performance to business goals, as well as Natalie Berg, an author, freelance journalist, and editor specializing in innovation, development, and marketing. Natalie recently wrote the ebook, State of Content Marketing for Retail. Before we get started, let me point out a few quick tips on how to make the most of today's live webinar. First, if you have any technical difficulties, troubleshoot by clicking on the Help widget at the bottom of the console marked with a question mark, or let us know via the Q&A box. You can also use the Q&A box to submit your questions to today's panelists. We'll be addressing select questions at the end of the hour, but you can send them in at any time. Please turn off any pop-up blockers on your computer so that you can utilize all of the widgets at the bottom of this console. Your console is interactive. Click on the Tips for Attendees widget below to learn how you can customize your experience today. With that, I'd like to pass it over to Joe Lazauskas to get us started.
Hi, everyone, and Joe, thanks for that great introduction. So I'm Joe Lazauskas. I'm the editor-in-chief of Contently, and at Contently, we're really passionate about content, about great content. Many people at our company are former journalists, and as a result, you know, one of the first things we did as a company was get our own content marketing efforts in gear. And as a result, we have an online magazine, The Content Strategist, which serves 150,000 readers each month, and a print magazine, Contently Quarterly, which comes out quarterly, and actually be shipping with every copy of Adweek in a couple weeks, so look out for that. Natalie, who joins us today, is one of my superstar writers, and, you know, as part of our online, you know, content marketing education, we, you know, submit an ebook each year on the state of content marketing in every industry. And a few months ago, Natalie wrote a fantastic ebook about the state of content marketing in the retail industry. She's one of the brightest content marketing writers out there. And for the first part of this webinar, she's going to be kind of guiding us through the biggest tips, trends, analysis, and best-in-class examples in content marketing in the retail industry. At the end, I'll be talking a little bit about content marketing measurement and the trends we're seeing there. And then we'll take some questions. Yeah, Natalie, take it away.
All right. Thanks so much, Joe. Before we get into some of those trends and best-in-class examples, it seems important to start by answering a really simple question, which is why? Why is content even important to the retail industry specifically? Why is it important that it's something you engage in? And the simple answer is because you have to. At this point, we have found that 54% of consumers demand a relationship with a retailer that creates relevant, tailor-made content. That means that it's no longer an extra or an add-on, an optional thing to do. For retailers, creating engaging content is really a must. So when Amaryllis Fox, who is the CEO of Mulu, which is kind of an innovator in the online content and retail space. When she says content is the new retail store, it's not even an exaggeration. There's really the lines between what is content and what is retail are kind of blending together because you can't really have one online without the other. It also is important, since content tends to be, these days, kind of a buzzword that is a large umbrella for a lot of things, for us to also talk about what it is that we're actually talking about. What is a piece of content? And the simplest way of answering that is that content is storytelling in a variety of different mediums. some that you'll see out on the internet include sponsored content, which appear in existing publications that look and act like journalistic articles that are sponsored by a brand. You'll see video that appear in a variety of locations that are brand videos. Infographics, you see those obviously floating around on the internet with really cool graphics that support some interesting facts or statistics in a particular industry or topic. And, of course, kind of the staple of a brand's content world is their blog, where they host their own content of any variety. And then particularly we see a lot in the retail industry, branded publications, which is a magazine, whether it is a physical magazine or a online digital magazine, that is, you know, separate from a brand's domain. It is not, you know, thegap.com. It is a publication that looks, acts, feels like a media company that creates content, not items for sale, but is actually owned and operated by the brand, or at least underwritten by the brand. So those are different forms that we find content in, out and about in the world in general and also in the retail world. So in digging through all of the content that's happening in the retail industry to create this ebook, there were a few specific trends that we saw happening across the industry and particularly across some of the brands that are doing the best job in the industry. And so we'll talk about some of those now. One of the biggest ones is mobile. Everybody's going to mobile, and we're seeing those statistics supported across the board in every industry. But what really makes it important for retail is we're finding that 4 out of 5 consumers are now using smartphones to shop. And if they're using their smartphones to shop, that's where the content has to be, if content is that important for sales. And it turns out it is. We're seeing that 20% of online sales are now coming directly from mobile devices. And it also is supporting physical sales. On Black Friday in 2013, 40% of traffic came from mobile. So you can kind of imagine people out, even in the real world, shopping, looking at their phones, seeing where their sales are, and that is driving real sales. But it's important for retailers to realize that even on mobile, people don't want sales-driven copy. They don't want a sales pitch. They want engaging, interesting storytelling. And studies are showing that sales-driven copy will result in abandonment rates more so than in engaging, interesting copy that really is consumer-focused, not focused on the product. A great example of this is Nordstrom's app, just their standard Nordstrom's app, which naturally does have a sales on it. You can purchase things from Nordstrom through their app. But there's a section called InStyle, and that is essentially a in-app blog that is photo-heavy. It includes articles and video that talks about fashion and trends, and also allows shoppers to engage with the content. They can write reviews of particular products. They can share products with friends via social networks or text message. So it also leverages some user-generated content, which really engages readers in a really exciting way right on their phones. Another trend we're seeing is brands managing to get real-time content to consumers and make a real successful transaction out of that. Meaning, rather than creating some content, putting it up on the internet, and hoping someone stumbles upon it at their leisure, they are finding out when and where the best time and place to target customers with particular content is and getting it to them in real time. An example of this would be pre-checkout upselling. In an online store, a customer that may be about to check out with their shopping cart has 4 items in it, and they're about to spend $80. And they go to hit checkout, and a window will pop up with a really engaging, interesting article that happens to mention that, hey, if you spend $100 today, you actually get this gold diamond earring set, which is a pretty pretty good deal. So a lot of times that will prompt the shopper to go back, buy another item, maybe another couple items, and earn that reward. But again, even in those cases, it's that engaging, customer-focused content that is successful more than just a kind of, you know, cheesy sales pitch. Another go ahead, Joe.
Oh, no, I was just going to add to that a lot of times what you see in terms of that upselling, in terms of that product, driven storytelling is not trying to make the hard sale, but it's telling the story behind the item, you know, the story behind that gold chain, where it was made, the craftsman that made them, that's really driving this kind of new wave of real-time retail purchases.
Right.
So,
go ahead. People don't have time for... Yeah, no problem. That's a great point. People don't often care what good of a deal it is. It's got to be a good story or they're just being sold to. So another way that retailers are using real-time is by geotargeting, which there's actually a number of ways to do this, both high-tech and low-tech. But this is finding targeting consumers by their location and getting them a customized piece of content based on their location. So it could be as simple as all of the Macy's customers in Chicago are going to get a article about a interesting up-and-coming designer in Chicago, which is far more interesting than a, you know, global story about fashion that may or may not relate to them in any way. You can do this as simply as using users' zip codes that they supply to you. But there are also some pretty cool high-tech ways that companies are doing this, and we'll actually explore that later on. But and finally, a kind of interesting thing that some brands are doing are actually poaching other brands' customers on Twitter. As we all know, Twitter is a pretty popular place for complaining about customer service issues. And some companies, like Walmart, has been known to do this. They'll wait for someone to complain about Best Buy, and when Best Buy doesn't reply, they will jump right in and say, hey, if you don't like the prices at Best Buy, if you don't like the service there, come check out Walmart. We're doing it better, which is it's kind of a slow way to pick up customers, but it's pretty effective because that is demonstrating some pretty incredible customer service where another retailer is failing. Speaking of social media, one unfortunate trend we're seeing with retailers is that social media is kind of a struggle. We're seeing that among the top 100 retailers on Facebook, even though they're averaging 1.2 million likes each, they only have 2% engagement. And we know across the board Facebook engagement has been tough for everybody, but that's still a pretty low engagement rate, particularly because when it's so high and effective elsewhere, Pinterest really is a gold mine for retailers. And yet, if you look across the board, 75% of retail product pages have a Facebook share button, but only 22% have Pinterest buttons, even though Pinterest is far more successful for actually selling products, which kind of exposes a disconnect in retailers' understanding of the value of Facebook versus Pinterest. And just to demonstrate how effective Pinterest is, during the first 3 weeks of the 2013 holiday season, Amazon averaged more than 16,300 pins per week, which is a lot of people actively interacting with their products and sharing them with friends. And pins themselves reportedly tripled online retailers' revenues on Cyber Monday last year as well. So that's pretty compelling statistics about the power of Pinterest. So what are brands talking about? Obviously, there are some kind of obvious examples. A lot of fashion and fashion retailers talk about fashion. But there's also some overall trends that we're seeing across the industry. Transparency is one of those, particularly because for consumers, a concern they have is with buying new things is what was the environmental impact of this new thing coming to me, being made, being shipped, and what has this done to, what is that the footprint of this item. So instead of trying to get consumers to forget about that, we're seeing a lot of retailers trying to be very transparent about their supply chain and include that as a part of their content plan. This includes interactive sourcing maps in which people can look on a map and see where the cotton from their jeans was grown, where it was woven, where it was actually made into the jeans, and how it got to them. Some are even including a tracking number on your pants, so you can see the exact factories where your pants went through. And the idea behind this is that the more transparent you can be, even if it's not a perfect system, these are the companies being honest about it, and they're engaging their audience and saying, we are doing our best and we're trying to get better, and this is where we are, and you're kind of a part of this journey with us. There are a number of companies doing this. A newer one is Zadie, which is a company that sells themselves on being clothes with a conscience. And they publish in-depth stories about every single item on their site. So you don't just get the story of, why this coat is in fashion. You get the story of where this coat came from. And people really get into that. In fact, people get into the environmental aspect of their clothing so much that Patagonia last year, in advance of Black Friday, released a 27-minute long film, which is just way too long, way longer than you'd expect anything to be successful. But it was a beautiful film, incredibly engaging, that basically begged people to not buy new clothes on Black Friday, which is kind of mind-boggling. It showed a variety of people who love their Patagonia clothes that they've had literally for decades. Some of them didn't even buy them. Some of them were hand-me-downs. Some of them got them at garage sales. And it talked about these people's relationship with this great piece of clothing that has been in their family and the impact and how they didn't need to buy new clothes because of this. And this is really something that resonates with consumers. And it was an incredibly successful film, and I bet it sold a lot more clothing than Patagonia would want to admit. So that is a topic we're seeing a lot of retailers address. Another trend is the way in which brands are publishing their content. There are two primary ways where they're doing this. Custom publications, in which they are the author and creator of the magazine itself. It used to be that, particularly for, let's say, in the fashion retailers, there were gatekeepers, which were your Vogues and your Vanity Fairs, that were between the fashion retailers and the consumers. They had to sell them the advertisements, and they had control over the finished product. Now that everyone's creating their own content, a lot of retailers are saying, why bother having someone else be the gatekeeper when we can create our ideal publication, and they're no longer technically spending ad dollars, they can make everything exactly the way they want. And we're seeing a lot of these coming out in really nice ways that are actually competing with and comparable to fine fashion and lifestyle magazines. There's Saturday's magazine, Frankenotes, The Edit, Netta Porter's Porter, as we mentioned earlier. These are some custom pubs that are almost undistinguishable from a magazine that you would pay, $10 for in the store. And some of these, in fact, do have price tags of their own. So So another way of doing this is partnering with existing publishers and doing sponsored content. So one of the most popular and successful ways of doing this is there's a site called Refinery29, which itself is a publisher of content and has made their content shoppable. So they publish stories about fashion, about lifestyle, about culture, and within each story, a retailer, Macy's, Guess, they will advertise or give you the opportunity to buy products that are either mentioned in the article or maybe just have something to do with the article or somehow related to it. So that is that's a really quick transition between reading engaging content and pushing a button to buy a great product. And though Refinery29 may not be a name that people recognize as much as, you know, a traditional publisher like Vanity Fair or Vogue, they get over a billion page views a year. So a lot of people are recognizing it. And it's there have been a lot of retailers using it to a lot of success. Finally, another type or another topic that we're seeing retailers have a lot of success with is utility content, meaning we're not necessarily creating content to entertain our customers. We're creating content that our customers need. One of the most well-known examples of this is the way that Nike has become integral to people's workout. They have their Nike Fuel Band, their Nike Plus running app. These track people's running routes with GPS. They log your running stats. They even cheer for you. They become part of people's fitness routine to the degree that some people can't work out without them. And we're seeing a lot of different companies doing this, that it tracks their actual weight loss and their calories and their sleep to the degree that they're really become a part of that part of the consumer's life, and that obviously ties that brand name to that part of their life as well in a really successful way. A different take on this is what Walgreens is doing with their pharmacy app, which functions a lot like a pharmacy inside your phone. There is a virtual pharmacist. It will remind you to take your pills and allow you to scan and refill your prescriptions. It has health resources, questions that, you know, 40 years ago somebody might go down to the pharmacy to ask their pharmacist these questions. And it's all right there on their phone, so they don't need to do that. And they don't need to, you know, WebMD something or Google it. It's, it becomes an integral part of people's health information, a resource that they really rely on and use. So this is a way in which content can serve a different purpose but be equally effective as just simply entertaining and informing. So now we'll move on to talk about some of the best-in-class examples, because while these are some of the overall trends, of course, there are kind of the cream of the crop in the industry, people who are really standing out and making a splash with what they're doing. And we mentioned earlier talking about the real-time content. And one of the pioneers in this is the jewelry retailer, Alex and Ani. They have used iBeacon technology, which is a GPS-type technology that is actually inside iPhones that shows them, creepy or not, exactly where their customers are. And when their customers physically are close to one of their stores, it sends them a message that says, hey, you're nearby, and Alex and Ani, we're having a sale, or we'd like to invite you in. And just during their trial period, 30% of people who received those real-time messages walked into the store. Half of them made purchases, which is a pretty dramatic return on that kind of investment. Needless to say, they went beyond their trial period and have invested in this technology for the entirety of their operations. We've mentioned this a couple times. Net-A-Porter has a relatively new, I believe it launched at the beginning of this year, a magazine called Porter. And it is, if you look at it on the shelf with all of the other fashion magazines, you could not call it out as a piece of branded content. It costs, I believe, $9.99, just like any other magazine. It is beautiful, high gloss, has the same kind of interesting cultural and fashion content that you'd find in Vogue or another type of fashion magazine. And yet it is exactly how Net-A-Porter wants their perspective on the fashion industry to appear. One thing that's really cool about this is it also has a digital companion called I Am Porter, which is kind of the iPad version of Porter. And this is fully shoppable. So you're looking at the content that is in Net-A-Porter. It has the full article about, you know, whatever interesting topic. And if you love that leather jacket that you're seeing in one of the photos of the article, you can buy it with a push of a button, which, again, shortens that transition between someone saying, ooh, look at that, and buying it. Finally, we have Rafa, which is a cycling company who has done a really incredible job of selling a lifestyle through incredible video. Instead of any sort of salesy content, there's nothing that you're going to find online in the content space where Rafa is trying to sell you a bike. What they have are incredible YouTube videos that they look like they could be Oscar clips. They're beautiful. That just show people on biking adventures in beautiful settings in the mountains. And you watch these videos, and it's incredibly compelling. You understand why people are so passionate about biking. And you can also see how many people are. They have more than 8,000 YouTube subscribers and nearly a million views. So they're getting a lot of people really, really engaged and in love with this cycling lifestyle that really directly feeds their goal of getting more people biking. So those are some of the best things we're seeing and some of the trends that we're seeing. And I'm going to pass it back to Joe to talk more about how some of these companies and brands are figuring out how effective this content is for them.
All right, great. Thank you so much, Natalie. That was fantastic and really informative. So, yeah, so if you're a brand and you're creating, you know, all this fantastic, interesting content, or maybe you're just getting underway, a big question you have is, how do I measure it? How do I tie it back to business results? This is something that at Contently we actually saw a lot with our own clients, you know, starting about a couple of years ago, where, you know, they're getting started and we're helping them, you know, connecting them with great freelance storytellers like Natalie, and they're creating awesome content, but they don't really know how to measure it. And that's because the traditional metrics that, you know, we've used for content in the publishing world for a long time are really meant for, you know, traditional sort of publishers. So by traditional, I don't mean, you know, print or TV, but, you know, companies that make money by selling ads. And when you're selling ads, what's been the dominant metric over the past two decades has been the page view. We like to call it here the page view industrial complex. And while this makes sense if, you know, you're a New York Times or you're Forbes and you're selling display ads, it doesn't really make sense if you're a brand, because what you're doing with your content is not trying to sell ads. What you're trying to do is build relationships with people. And so, you know, we start off with this hypothesis that you know, marketers really are pretty, content marketers are very unsure of how to measure the effectiveness of the content they're producing. So one thing we did out, we're really database people, so we went out and we did a study. And so in the study, we surveyed 500 B2B and B2C marketers who read our magazine and asked them what metrics they're using to measure the success of their content. And so our hypothesis was kind of, you know, proven correct even right off the bat. We saw that most people are primarily using page views, unique visitors, social shares and likes, which are, you know, are good metrics within a whole holistic core of measurement, but doesn't really tell you a whole lot about how your content is building relationships with consumers. We also asked them, you know, how confident they were in the metrics that they're using, and that they're, how confident they are that those metrics are tying back to business results. And what we saw was that, you know, only about 9% of the 500 marketers we surveyed said they were very confident. 91% were expressing some amount of doubt. You know, moving forward, we also, you know, asked them what's on their Christmas list. So, all right, they're struggling with measurement. What do they want to be measuring? And what we saw there was a lot about relationship-minded metrics, so how people's opinions of their brands are changing because of the content, how much more people are likely to buy that content. And at that point, we decided that we really wanted to set out to help solve this problem for marketers. And this right here, this is actually a snapshot of something that our development team wrote on the wall at our office here in Soho, New York. We have you know, those whiteboard walls, and they're all people, not visitors. So that really drills down to thinking about content measurement in terms of the people that you're building those relationships with, and not just these, you know, IP addresses that are coming and clicking and corresponding to some sort of amount of display ad payoff for you. Because that's the business that brands are in. They're in the business of building relationships with people. And so we started really digging into what metrics are going to deliver that for brands. And, you know, there's a whole slew of metrics that brands should be looking at, but one of the prime ones is engaged time. And engaged time delivers lasting relationships, and here's why. If you look at, you know, engagement, so engaged time being the amount of time that someone's on the page with your content, and they're scrolling, and they're clicking, and they're highlighting, they're actively engaged. They're not just, you know, leaving the, you know, the tab open while microwaving a pizza in the other room. They're actually engaging with the content. If you can get someone to engage for 3 minutes with your content, there's over a 50% chance that they're going to return again within the next week. And ultimately, you're not going to build a relationship with anyone unless you're getting them to return again and again and again. And to me, this is really, this is via Sharpie, it's one of the best analytics platforms out there right now, and really great thought leaders in their own right. And this is a stat that consistently blows me away, that if you can just manage to do that, if you can tell a story that keeps someone there for 3 minutes, there's a really good chance they're going to come back. And, you know, but really right now, what most marketers are looking at is Google Analytics, which is, you know, a great tool, a tool I use every day. However, it doesn't really drill down into the way that people are interacting with your content. You can see, you know, those page views, those unique users, but you don't see how long they're spending. You don't see when they're dropping off the page. You don't see how many of them are actually finishing your article, which is crucial, crucial information for a brand publisher in 2014. So in response, we decided to build a tool that would help, you know, the brands you work with do that. This is a view, a monthly view of our publication, The Content Strategist. So, you know, what we look at is the average time people are spending with the content, total time they're spending, and really also drill down into each person each day so we can see how are you doing today, how can we get better tomorrow. Right here is a view of, you know, an individual story. So it tells us, you know, insights automatically, kind of what's going on with the story, what different traffic drivers are. And we also use that to figure out what to prioritize in terms of distribution on our social channels, figure out how to prioritize distribution when we do, you know, a little bit of promoted Facebook posts and promoted tweets, and really translate those, you know, ad dollars not to display ads, but to giving your content more of a boost to putting it in front of people who are going to spend time with you. So that's really where the content measurement conversation is going right now. It's a debate that's heating up more and more every day, but also it's allowing marketers to tie a firm ROI to their content, to track the relationships with people that they're having over time, to track that always-on sales funnel, so that at the end of the day, they can, you know, go to their bosses and really connect the dots between the content you're producing, the great stories you're telling, and the relationships you're having with people, and thus the sales you're making as a retailer. So right now, I'm going to throw it back to Joe Keenan.
Great. Well, thanks, Joe and Natalie. Some great insights there. We now have some time for some questions from the audience. I just want to remind everyone that you can submit your questions to Natalie and Joe by using the Q&A box on the bottom of your console. So we have a couple questions we can get started with. The first question here is for you, Natalie. It is, in your opinion, what is the best way for an in-house marketer to plan to create fresh content regularly, and this person will be writing that content? Should they be doing it in small bursts or by carving out longer time periods each week to be writing that content?
That is a terrific question. I think Joe's probably the best suited to actually answer this question than I am, because I think he does a little bit more of this than myself. If I'm not mistaken, probably editorial calendar is a good place to start. Would that be correct, Joe?
Yeah, I mean, really the editorial calendar is at the heart of any content marketing effort. You know, it's always on. I really think that if you're a brand, you're, you know, a content marketer, and you want to really do content right, you have to take on that. Yeah, you have to put on your editor hat. And really map out the content you're going to be creating each day and plan for it. If you're working with other writers, you know, plan in the time that you're going to really work on a piece and you're going to craft revisions. I think Natalie will tell you I can be a pain in the butt when it comes to revisions, but, you know, a lot of the times the, you know, piece comes out really great afterwards. If you're, you know, just planning to write for yourself, you know, if you're doing a one-man or a one-woman show, you know, the biggest thing to me really is, you know, it's consistency and it's quality. I think it's really hard to build an audience if you're publishing less than one time a day. You know, I think three times a week you can get away with, but you also just don't want to be churning out, you know, junk. So, you know, it's finding that right mix where you're constantly generating ideas and figuring out what's compelling content you're going to create all the time. One trick I like to use is, you know, which a lot of writers use, which is just the list. It's a big spreadsheet of story ideas, and anytime anything pops into your head, you put it in there, and then, you know, when you're really searching for content, you have this whole well of information, and you can get something done. But yeah, it's, you know, and everyone's creativity has a different, you know, a different way of working. Some people like to being out a lot in short bursts, others like to set aside consistent time every day, but it's really just about, you know, doing the work day after day.
Okay. Another question we have here, this one is in regards to Instagram, and I know you talked a little bit about Instagram, Natalie. This attendee wants to know, where do you see Instagram and how can brands use that in retargeting and sales going forward in regards to sort of leveraging Instagram as a tool for their content marketing efforts and specific to sales?
Sure. That's a great question. Because Pinterest is such a retail powerhouse, most of the success stories we found were there on Pinterest. Because Instagram is a image-based social network, it also has a lot of value. But what we're actually seeing more brands having success with, and this is kind of across the board, not just in retail, but with Instagram doing the short Instagram videos, which are similar to Vine videos, people are finding, consumers are finding pretty compelling. And Joe, have you seen examples of people doing really, nobody's Instagram strategy really jumped out as something really innovative. That doesn't mean it's impossible to do, but we're just not seeing a whole lot of it.
Yeah, I mean, Instagram is a really tough, network for direct sales. It's really not what it's meant for. Pinterest, because of the nature of pins, it goes to direct links to products. It's much better, as Natalie said, for those direct conversions. But Instagram is really more of a brand awareness platform. And there's actually Instagram recently, in a very limited way, opened up ads on their platform. And we've seen that, the instances where brands went for, a post that felt like an ad and it shows up in someone's feed, users have a very negative reaction to that. But when you can, post something that's, like, really real and native to the platform, it does really well. Adidas recently, with Adidas TV, they created a web series starring Little John that is, usually you think about web series, you think about YouTube, but with the kind of shortest attention span of the upcoming post-millennial generation, really Instagram video is a great avenue to go in. And in these 15-second videos, they just have these wild, really frenetic episodes starring Little John that tell the story in a really, quick, flashy kind of way. And, what you're doing there is really building, a sense of affinity to the brand on Instagram, but you're not going to drive a lot of sales. And if you try to, you're probably going to see a lot of backlash on the platform.
Okay. Next question here is in regards to, do you have any tools, and this can be either Joe or Natalie, tools in collecting feedback from your audience to kind of get a sense of what content they're interested in? Any ideas or thoughts on that?
I think that, Twitter is a great place just to, you see people, tweeting your stuff and just engaging in conversation with them there. That's something I like to do when I'm bored. But also, I actually love SurveyMonkey if you want to get some really standard basic questions answered. They're cheap, they're easy to use. The data is really visually appealing on the back end. We've also just kind of sent out open-ended questionnaires to our audience, just asking them to identify some things about themselves. Who are you? What do you work for? How often do you read our stuff? Why do you read our stuff? What do you find most useful? What would you like to see more of? And I was actually shocked at the robust response we got for that. So, yeah, it's really just, people, if they're reading your stuff, if they're starting to have a relationship with you, they want to let you know what they like and they dislike. It's really often a matter of just asking. There's a lot of really simple questionnaire and survey tools out there that will help you do that.
Okay.
Now, do you have anything to add to that? Or?
No, I think that's great. I agree.
Great.
Okay. And then this attendee said recently started a blog and just looking for some ideas, how can they sort of promote that blog? What are your guys' tips for kind of getting a new blog out to the audience?
Social media obviously is a great place to start, but what's often frustrating when you're starting a new publication is that your following is so small. So in that case, if you have a bit of a marketing budget to acquire an audience, I think that there are a few avenues that can be really helpful. One is, it's promoted tweets, which is great because you get a double bonus of getting a lot of visibility to a specific story, but also to your account, which helps you gain followers. The same thing with sponsored posts on Facebook. If you can give a little bit of a budget, even if it's only maybe $10 a day, that can help a lot to starting to build an audience. Outbrain and Taboola as well, if you're looking to, you know, drive, you know, an increase in audience traffic, are pretty cheap on the, you know, cost per click level, about 18 to 25 cents. And, you know, one of the biggest things you can do is really make content that can appeal to certain influencers and get in front of those influencers, even if it's just from hitting them up with an email or tweeting at them, because it's so much easier to reach one person that can reach 500 people than to reach 500 people individually.
Okay. Another question here is in regards to sort of scheduling out the content writing or production within an organization, and how do you go about determining whether it's best to do that in-house, and if so, in-house, I guess, do you look to your marketing department, or who do you think would be best to handle sort of these content marketing tasks, or do you go hire a freelancer to do that type of work? What are the considerations that a company should be taking into account?
Yeah, I think that having, you know, some sort of technology that helps you do that is really valuable. I've been using our internal software Contently for a couple of years now, and, you know, I can't really even imagine how I did in the days before running publications without, you know, a really robust editorial calendar tool and a tool that allowed me to connect to all my writers and manage them. So, you know, it doesn't have to be our option, but finding some option out there that'll help you really manage your whole editorial process in a platform. In terms of whether you should look internally or to a freelancer, I think it really depends on who you have on your team. I believe very strongly in putting your content marketing efforts in the hands of someone who has real editorial experience, who has built a site before, who's built an audience, who has produced content day in and day out, because it's just a skill that you won't have otherwise. You know, marketers are really great at what they do, at, you know, at the art of reaching people through, you know, the different mediums that, you know, they've learned over the years. But if they haven't run a publication before, you're probably going to be up a creek without a paddle and not really knowing what to do. So if that's the case, I definitely would recommend bringing in someone with real editorial experience to help guide that process for you, to really, you know, be your leader and to give a lot of creative juice to your content marketing efforts.
Next question I have here is in regards to a company's B2B, and their question is, should their content on their site be gated, sort of like a registration to access the content? Do you recommend just having, you know, all access to all of the content? What are your thoughts around sort of that gated content versus free access to content?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that, you know, certainly you don't want to put up too many walls to keep you people to access your, to keep people away from accessing your content. That's not a very good idea. I'll tell you how we do it at Contently is, you know, we publish 4 normal posts a day, you know, standard articles or feature articles, and, you know, we don't gate those at all. But every week or two, we'll publish an ebook or a report or a white paper, really deeper dives, much longer pieces, proprietary research. And those are the ones that we gate, that we put a landing page in front of, where you're basically paying for it with an email address, because, you know, that's just getting you a nice influx of prospects and helping really build relationships with those people. So, yeah, you have to have special content that you're going to gate, but your day-to-day, your bread-and-butter content, don't gate that at all.
And I would add, as a freelance journalist who's often, you know, digging through the Internet for sources and information, if something is too well-gated, if you actually have to pay for something or be a customer, you can miss an opportunity to earn some media if a journalist is like, oh, finally, I found this study that, you know, is addressing something I'm researching, and they just can't get to it. So if it's you know, I have no problem putting my email address in something to get the access to something, but you can really cut off some of the reach if you're making it too hard to get to for people who want to use it that will actually in a way that will benefit you.
Yeah, that's a really great point. If your download form has more than three fields, you're doing it wrong. Make it easy for people to download your content. You've already got them there. Don't drive them away.
Interesting. Next question is in regards to the video. Natalie, you mentioned the Patagonia, the 27-minute video or film. For companies that don't really have the ability to do that, whether it's the time or the resources, what are some tips, and Joe, you can jump in on this as well, as far as using video as part of your content marketing efforts for maybe the smaller to mid-sized business that doesn't have the resources that Patagonia does?
Well, they don't all have to be, a cinematic splendor like Patagonia has done. But video plays such a huge role in what consumers want now. We're seeing this across all industries. I was just working on a similar ebook for the financial services industry, and they're super into video. That's how people, a lot of consumers want to engage with content is through video. And it doesn't have to necessarily be a high budget item, depending on how you do it. There are some companies, as I mentioned earlier, doing amazing things with Vine videos, and those are like 6.5 seconds long. They don't take a lot of investment, they just take a lot of creativity.
Yeah, I think Natalie's right on there that video production has really been democratized. Anyone can do it. The equipment doesn't cost very much. You get a pretty nice video camera for a few $100. It's going to do a pretty good job. And, yeah, you can even make a lot of stuff on your phone right now. So get out there, do it, test new things, see what resonates with people, and maybe you land on a strategy that works. But, with all content, you're going to make mistakes. You're going to have duds, and you're going to have hits if you do it enough. So just get out there, try new things, and be willing to take some risks.
Okay. Another question here, and as summer's coming to an end and we're moving into fall, and then after that, shortly after that, the busy holiday season, fourth quarter for retailers. Any ways that retailers can use content marketing as part of their holiday marketing strategies? Any types of good campaigns that you think would be effective, or any tips you would have specific to content marketing over the holidays?
And Natalie, you want to take this one?
That is a great question. There are so many themes that resonate with people over the holidays, from family to travel to gift giving. I think taking one of these traditional themes and coming up with a new spin on it is a good approach to take. The most important thing is to really strategize, and as you mentioned, it's coming. This is probably the time to start strategizing for retailers in the holiday season. To really have a plan for not to have a bunch of scattershot, whether it's videos or articles or social media posts, but to have a plan in place now that tells not a whole bunch of, as I said, scattershot stories, but really tells a story gradually throughout the season, and that's really going to create a better experience for a customer having a relationship with your brand over the season. So deciding whatever that story is you want to tell that is somehow related to the holidays, and tell it in an incremental, compelling way over, the whole fourth quarter, I think is a good way for people to feel like you're doing something interesting and cool and they're wanting to keep paying attention all the way to that last day of holiday shopping. Is that a good way of
trying
to answer the actual question?
I mean, it's hard to give, specific advice for content campaigns without, knowing the nuts and bolts and the things that make a specific brand unique. But, you know, the holiday is a time that's really rich in story. And, you know, one of the pieces of holiday storytelling by brand that I loved the most recently was when Coca-Cola told the story behind, you know, how they sort of invented Santa Claus and was an incredibly successful piece of brand content, you know, shared thousands and thousands of times. And obviously not everyone's a Coca-Cola, but everyone has that, you know, sort of unique personal holiday story that you can find a way to tell, whether it's the story behind your products or the story behind your team or your owners. Really giving that, you know, warm behind-the-scenes look is something that people really love that time of year.
Okay.
I agree.
Well, yep, thank you. So looks like we're just about out of time. I want to take this opportunity first to thank Joe Lazauskas and Natalie Berg for their time today. On behalf of Retail Online Integration and Blue Toad, the sponsor of today's webinar, I want to thank you, the audience, for attending today. Be sure to check out our webinar page to get the information on all of Retail Online Integration's archived and upcoming webinars. With that, I'd like to say thanks again, and I hope to see you at the next ROI webinar. Have a great day, everyone.